Chapter 1. Tote. Of Beauty. The story goes on to tell how Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. That is correct. And we have instances of the fact which the saga further states, namely that Joseph brought unto their father their evil report. It would not be hard to find a point of view from which Joseph could be regarded as an unlicked cub. It was the brother's point of view. I do not share it. Or rather, I might entertain it for a moment, but I would give it up. For Joseph was more. The passages I have quoted, however, require explanation, each in turn, that the lie of the land may be clear, and that which has shrunk away into the past may be expanded again into its true proportions and presentness. Joseph was 17 years old, and in the eyes of all who saw him, the most beautiful among the children of men. I confess that I do not care for talk about beauty. The word and the idea are alike tiresome, for beauty is a conception as pallid as it is lofty, a pedant's dream. There are supposed to be laws of beauty, but a law addresses itself to the understanding and not to the emotions, for these do not brook the understanding's control. Hence the vapidness of perfect beauty, which leaves nothing to be forgiven. For the emotions need something to forgive, else they turn away in sheer boredom. Nobody but the schoolmaster, with his love of the accepted and formalized, can pay so much honor to mere perfection as to wax enthusiastic over it, and to that kind of enthusiasm it is hard to ascribe much depth. A law is outwardly binding and edifying, but inward compulsion is a matter not of law but of magic. Beauty is a magic worked upon the emotions, as such always half illusory, very vacillating and ephemeral in its effect. Set an ugly head upon a beautiful body, and the body itself is no longer beautiful in any sense which can touch the emotions, except perhaps in the dark, and then delusion comes in. And indeed, how much delusion, trickery, and deceit are involved in this matter. The world is full of stories about youths disguised as women turning men's heads, of girls in doublet and hose awaking the passions of their own sex. And in every case, when the fraud is discovered, the emotions subside, because the beauty no longer serves a practical end. Perhaps even human beauty, in its effect upon the feelings, is nothing at all but the magic of sex. Sex itself become visible, so that one might better speak of a complete man, a perfectly feminine woman, than of a beautiful one. Only by dint of a victory over self can one woman or one man speak of another as beautiful. Cases in which emotional effectiveness triumphs over obvious unpracticality are rare, though of course they occur and can be proved. What comes into play here is the moment of youth, that is to say, a magic which the emotions are prone to confuse with beauty, so that youth, if it is not marred by all too disturbing flaws, affects the beholder as beauty, and is even so affected itself as its smile unmistakably betrays. For it possesses charm, a phenomenon which, of its very nature, forever hovers between the masculine and the feminine. A youth of 17 is not beautiful in the sense of perfect masculinity, nor yet in the sense of fruitless femininity. That would be worst of all. But so much we must admit, that beauty in the guise of youth must always, both inwardly and outwardly, incline toward the feminine. That is its essence. That conditions the tenderness between it and the world that is betrayed by its smile. At 17, it is true, one can be more lovely than woman or man, lovely like woman and man, lovely in both ways and in all, beautiful and well-favored to a pitch that makes both men and women fall head over heels in love. So was it with Rachel's son, and so it is that we are told that he was the most well-favored among the children of men. That was exaggerated praise, since there were and are hosts of his like, since the time when man no longer lived in the deep or crawled on his belly, but had traveled some way toward the bodily image of God, many a youth of 17 has displayed to admiring eyes quite as slender legs and narrow hips, quite such a well-shaped throat and golden-brown skin. Many a youth has seemed neither too tall nor too short, but precisely the right height. Many have known how to stand and to walk in a way that is half divine. Many have found the exquisite mean between delicacy and strength of form. And it is not extraordinary either that upon such a body there should sit not a dog's head, but a very winning human one, smiling to boot with a smile that is half divine. That happens every day. But in Joseph's world, and in his circle, his was the person and his the presence which practiced the magic of beauty upon the emotions of the beholder. It was generally felt that upon his lips, which, save when they moved to speak or smile, were certainly too full, the Eternal had poured out grace. True, there was an opposition party. Here and there was ill will against him, but it proved nothing, and one cannot even say that it did not share the prevailing opinion, for much goes to show that the brethren's hatred for Joseph was nothing but the reverse side of the universal adoration. The Shepherd. So much for Joseph's beauty and his 17 years. That he kept the flocks with his brothers, that is, with the children of Zilpah and Bilhah, is a statement which likewise calls for explanation, qualification, and expansion. Jacob, the man of the blessing, was a stranger in the land, a ger, as they say, a tolerated and respected guest, not because he had dwelt so long out of his own land, but by nature, rank, and inheritance, as son of his fathers, who also had been gerim. He had not become an established citizen and member of the ruling class in the city. Not therein lay the dignity he possessed. It had its source in wisdom and riches, both together, and in the impressiveness of his person and bearing, but not in his manner of life, for that was lax, though quite legal, and characterized by what one might call a regular irregularity. He lived in tents before the walls of Hebron, as once he had dwelt before Shechem's gates, and might one day set out again to seek other springs and pasture lands. And yet he was no Bedouin, with the mark of Cain upon his brow, the sign of vagrancy and rapine, a terror and an abomination to town-dwellers and peasants alike. That, not at all. His God was like the other Baals of the land in their deadly enmity against Amalek, as he had many times proved by arming his people that they might help the dwellers in Hebron and the cattle-keeping peasantry to thrust back the oncoming hordes from the deserts of the south, camel-breeding folk bent on plunder, their faces painted with their tribal signs. Yet Jacob himself was no peasant, quite expressly and consciously not. It would not have harmonized with his religious feelings, which were so different from those of the sun-burnt tillers of the soil. Moreover, as ger and guest, he had no right to the ownership of land, save only his dwelling places. He rented a little plough-land, now here, now there, sometimes smooth and level, sometimes steep and rocky, with rich soil between the stones, where corn and barley might sprout. It was worked by his sons and slaves. Joseph, too, sometimes played sower and reaper, as well as shepherd, as everybody knows. But this casual kind of farming had little meaning in Jacob's life. He practiced it half-heartedly, as evidence of some sort of permanence. For his life's true riches and substance lay in his teeming, movable property, the flocks. He exchanged all they produced for plentiful supplies of corn and oil, figs, pomegranates, honey, even silver and gold, and the possession of them determined his relation to townsfolk and countryfolk, a relation carefully regulated and qualified by many contracts which gave him civic standing, despite the anomalous character of the life he led. And for the sake of his flocks, he required good business relations with the inhabitants, the tradesmen in the town, and the peasants who worked for or rented of them. If Jacob wanted any settled life at all, if he did not wish to be thought of as a nomad who had broken into others' land and laid it waste, He needed to have fixed and friendly contracts with the people of Baal, stipulating that he might drive his flocks into the stubble and let them rove and crop over the fallow land. For the moment, indeed, there was less of this up here in the hills. There had been a long and blessed season of peace. The highways were full of coming and going. The land-exploiting town-dweller grew fat on the caravan trade, on payments for warehousing, lading, and convoy for goods that came from the land of Marduk via Damascus, along the road east of the Jordan, through that district to the sea, and thence to the land of mud, or the other way round. And the town-dweller accumulated land, farming it by the labor of slaves or debtors. Its produce enriched him, aside from the profits he made on his business. Thus, even as the sons of Isulanu did to Laban, he got the peasants under his thumb by making them loans. Cultivation and settlement rapidly increased. They encroached upon the grassland, and it came about that as once the meadows of Sodom could not support both Lot and Abram together, so now the land could no longer support Jacob. He had to divide his flocks. It was arranged that the larger part should be sent to pasture 5 days' journey to the north, in that well-watered vale of Shechem where he had been before. Thither went in the main the sons of Leah, from Reuben down to Zebulun, while only the 4 of Bilhah and Zilpah and the 2 of Rachel lived with their father. So that it was as with pictures of the signs of the zodiac, of which 6 only are visible to the eye at a time, an image or parable to which Joseph never tired of referring. The 6 at Shechem did, it is important to say, return when it was harvest time at Hebron, and more hands were needed, but mostly they were 4 or 5 days distant, an equally important fact, which explains the saying that Joseph was with the sons of the maids. But Joseph did not work every day with the brethren in meadow and field. We must not take his labors too seriously. Not always did he tend the flocks, or turn up the plowland for the winter's sowing when it was soft from the rains. Rather, he only worked now and then, when he thought of it, or felt like it. Jacob, his father, granted him much free time for labors of a higher kind, of which I shall presently speak. But when he did work with the brethren, in what character was it? As helper or as overseer? The brothers never knew. They would order him about as the youngest, and roughly enough, but he did little work and behaved not as though he belonged with them, one among the sons of his father, but as the father's representative and emissary, set there to spy. The result was that they disliked having him, and yet were vexed when he took a notion to stop at home. Lessons. When that happened, he sat with old Eliezer beneath the tree of God, the great terebinth beside the well, occupied in the pursuit of knowledge. People said of old Eliezer that he was like Abraham in the face. Actually, they could not know this, for none of them had seen the Chaldean, nor had any picture or likeness of him come down the ages. The assertion could only be an indirect way of saying that Eliezer's features helped them when they tried to conjure an image of the original wanderer and friend of God. This was not so much because they were large and stately, like his whole figure and bearing, but rather because there was something about them of the tranquilly generalized and divinely inexpressive, which made it easy to transfer them to a venerable unknown of past time. Eliezer was a little older than Jacob, and dressed like him in garments which were partly Bedouin, partly in the fashion of the people of Shinar, with looped and fringed draperies and a scarf-like girdle wherein his writing materials were stuck. His forehead, so far as the headcloth left it free, was serene and unwrinkled. The still dark eyebrows ran in a flat, narrow curve from the broad and shallow base of the nose to the temples. Beneath them, the formation of the eyes was such that the almost lashless upper and lower lids, heavy and, as it were, swollen, looked like lips, between which the black eyeballs rounded out. The nose, thin-nostrilled and flat-boned, drooped down to the narrow mustache which ran from the corners of the mouth and lay upon the yellowish beard. Below it hung the even red line of the lower lip. The cheeks, with 1,000 little wrinkles in their yellow skin, stood out above the line of the beard, and this line, where cheek and beard met, was so extraordinarily even as to suggest that the beard was fastened behind the ears and could be taken off. Or rather, the whole face suggested a mask, with Eliezer's own underneath. Joseph remembered thinking so as a child. There were current all sorts of absurd stories about Eliezer himself and his origins, with which I will deal further on. For the present, it is enough to say that he was Jacob's house steward and eldest slave, could read and write, and was acting as Joseph's teacher. "Tell me, son of the true wife," he might address the lad as they sat together in the shade of the tree of enlightenment, "for what three reasons did God create man last, after the beasts and all growing things?" To which Joseph would make answer, "God created man last, firstly, lest someone might say he had holpen at the rest of the work. Secondly, for the humbling of man, that he must needs say to himself, 'The blowfly was born before me.' But thirdly, that he might sit down straightway to the meal, as the guest for whom all things had been made ready." Whereto Eliezer would respond with satisfaction, "Thou sayest," and Joseph would laugh. But that was the least of it. It was only one instance of all the exercises in quick wit and memory, the countless little sayings and snatches of ancient time in which the boy must become versed. Eliezer had begun this teaching in Joseph's tender childhood, and Joseph had long known how to enchant his hearers with his graceful repetitions, though they were silly enough about him, even without that. Thus, at the well, he had tried to divert his father with his fable of the names and naming, how the damsel, Ishkara, demanded the name of God from the lustful messenger, and how no sooner had she learned the true and rightful one than she had called it out and vaulted upwards, thus bringing to scorn the importunate Senhazai, and how the Lord had received her in great favor on high, saying unto her, "Thou hast escaped from the snare of sin, and therefore will we give thee thy place in the heavens," and how that was the origin of the constellation of the Virgin. But Senhazai, alas, had had to stop down below in the dust, until that day when Jacob, son of Yitzchak, dreamed by Bethel his dream of the ladder leading up to heaven. Only upon that ladder had Senhazai been able to mount once more, deeply humiliated that he could do so only in a human being's dream.